In fact, if you think of it, it's just an extraordinary thing, really, that we're here tonight. How many obstacles cleared away, how much positive karma ripening here, how many other people would like to be here but are beset by the whole array of samsaric obstacles. Whenever you feel discouraged, this is something to contemplate. The extraordinary nature of the present moment that allows you, that gives you the resources and the freedoms to practice the Dharma, to think about generating mindfulness, compassion, wisdom, patience, forgiveness, effort, generosity. The moment arises to practice. Seize that moment because it's rare and precious. So, Venerable Dhammadina this morning was talking about personal integrity or a practice of ethics as being the foundation for everything else. So, in the Mahayana tradition, you know, we have this way of condensing the Eightfold Noble Path, and we say it can be condensed into ethics, concentration, and wisdom. Yeah, that's just a condensed form of the Eightfold Noble Path. So ethics first. Ethics, everything is built on ethics. And that's not because you have to be a good person to achieve your meditation or achieve wisdom. It's because without that stable basis of a personal practice of ethics, the mind is simply too chaotic to sit in meditation. One can't gather the mind because it's too distracted by the whole, you know, grinding over this poorly done thing or this murky situation in one's life or guilt over this, and then the whole energy draining things of denial or rationalization. You know, when we don't, we have to substitute something for an ethical practice because deep down we all want to feel good about ourselves. So if we don't have the wise ethical practice, then we're going to substitute something for that to make ourselves feel better about ourselves. Well, what is that? The untrained thing you substitute is denial, trying hard not to think about it. And then the other is even more dangerous, although they're both dangerous to ourselves and others, is rationalization, somehow justifying, putting a lot of mental energy into creating the whole structures for rationalizing why it's okay that dot, 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 dot. Yeah, so if we're all busy, if our energy is all taken up by that, very chaotic, difficult to sustain mental confusion, then of course it's very, very difficult to collect the mind in the present moment without being dragged into the past or the future. Which means we can't achieve any kind of concentration. If we can't achieve any kind of concentration, we can't achieve wisdom. The ultimate realization, wisdom. Yeah? So, you know, it's all a practice, is all a, you know, it's all a many things required to create the conditions, create the causes for our progress, our development, our realization. And the fundamental foundation, we call it the foundation practice, is the practice of personal integrity. And then, of course, along the way, by the way, one also gets the benefits of creating the causes for happiness. special 2-for-1. Realization plus mundane happiness. Who could resist such a good offer? Because, of course, our practice of personal integrity, as Venerable is saying, is the basis or the cause, one of the causes for, the cause for mundane happiness, and kind of the cutting the really gross suffering. Yeah, the gross level of suffering. So, y'all know who Nagarjuna is? Nagarjuna is a Mahayana bigwig. Maybe the most famous of all of Mahayana pandits, yogi scholars. And Nagarjuna in Precious Garland, he's got this very intriguing, interesting sentence where he says, all Dharma practices are for the sake of wisdom. Which is a very interesting thing to mull over for a few years. Of course, wisdom in our Dharma practice, you know, the kind of the basic understanding of Dharma is that the more we are mistaken about the nature of reality, the more we will suffer. The more our wisdom, the less we will suffer. Which isn't to say, you know, even, of course, with great realization, one still experiences painful situations, one still experiences losses, one still experiences simple pain, but what's not necessary to experience, what we can alleviate, what we can eradicate as Dharma practitioners, is the suffering that we add on top of painful experiences. That suffering is not necessary. And it is our practice of mindfulness upon which the achievement of wisdom, it is upon that basis that we eradicate that unnecessary suffering. So, I was also going to say a thing about restraint, but I'm going to save that for a little bit, because I know we're just dying to get back to all that great discussion on the ethical practices. So let's go on and just review these four factors again. So we said that the four factors that make a complete action. So now the complete action is the action that can compel a particular rebirth. Now, if you don't have confidence in multiple lives, actually, that's something that comes with familiarity and with looking at one's life, one's experiences, and eventually at some point I have to say that as a Dharma practitioner, I mean, we don't grow up with it. Most of us aren't fortunate enough to grow up with that view, so it doesn't come readily. But eventually as a Dharma practitioner, if you just be patient with that, set it aside, and not get too, you know, reified about hating the whole idea of it. Eventually, it begins to appear that it makes a lot more sense than the alternatives. I just leave that at that. The alternatives begin to sound pretty silly to one eventually. But even if we don't have confidence in this unending continuity of consciousness, nevertheless, you know, there's a way in which we die every day and are reborn. We take rebirth. You know, in terms of this very subtle kind of impermanence in which from moment to moment nothing remains, not physical. not mental. Everything changes from moment to moment. All new. And we have this appearance of stability, but it's a mere appearance. It's not the way things actually exist. Yeah? So, and one way you could say that you go to bed at night, you wake up in the morning, and you take rebirth with a different mind and a different body. When you talk to a biologist, they'll tell you all those, almost all the cells are new, and even the ones that aren't brand new, all of their little atoms and molecules will all rearrange themselves and moved around a zillion times since the night before. So, and you know from moment to moment because you're meditators. This is one of the things you're getting a experiential understanding of, is that from moment to moment in the consciousness, nothing remains the same. Yeah? So when we say rebirth, one can also think of that rebirth, a karma that impels or throws, a rebirth suddenly in the midst of this apparently continuous life. One day we are like this, and due to the ripening of karma, the next day, new body and mind. Yeah? Just a little thought to consider if you get stuck on this rebirth thing and the importance of a complete action. Because there's a lot of importance to whether our actions are complete or not. And understanding this little kind of the technology, the user's manual to karma, understanding the technology of karma, then we can work according to our abilities with our situations. And even as Venerable Dhammadina was discussing this morning, even the ones that are really beyond us, we can't make what is the ultimately best ethical choice. Sometimes we're just not able to do it due to our personal limitations. Yeah? So it's important to understand how to mitigate the effect of those negative actions, those akusala intentions, how to mitigate the effect on our consciousness. Yeah? So that we don't become, that we don't create the causes for an akusala experiences in the future. Yeah. So these four factors in a complete action, if any of them are missing, then that karma is a lot less powerful. Now that goes for positive actions as well as negative. So if we engage in a positive action, we want to be sure we get it complete. We don't want to miss the factors in our positive actions and actions that we're not yet able to really get on top of. We want to mitigate their influence on us. Yeah. So, as we said, what were our four? The first was then to get the right object. Okay. The second was to, is the motivation, yeah, the intention. We said that's almost identical to karma itself, that intention. Now I don't have my list. What is the third one? The actual action, yeah, that's, yeah, we do the thing. I mean, that's an important one to understand because there is a difference between having the intention and getting in there and not acting it out. Yeah, so there's stopping where we can. Yeah, there's a difference in the karma. Yeah, so even if we intended to swat the fly, and there's some karma with that intention. Yes, there's. It affects us. It affects. You see, we're making our mind. We're creating. We're making a habit. We're cooking the We're adding the ingredients, yeah? That's not such a great analogy, but you get my drift. But to not actually, to stop before we actually swat the fly makes a difference.
Or if the fly flies away and we miss.
That's good too. Because, you know, sometimes we miss because we're not quite fully on board to do the thing. You know, like sometimes we miss, we don't accomplish our negative aims because we're not really committed to it fully. So sometimes our less powerful doubting mind kind of makes us miss. You know? That's less powerful karma. It doesn't have the impact on it. It's not creating us. It's not concocting us in the way that a complete karma would. Now, the fourth one is really important because we got a lot of control over that. Even having done the deed, the complete action is to rejoice in it. So remember I said how important the bookend is to our action, the dedication, the rejoicing. So we've got the motivation at the beginning, we've got the rejoicing after. If we know it was an akusala action, but we did it anyway, as Dharma practitioners, to have the courage to say, I regret this. I wish I hadn't done it. That regret, not only does it weaken the power of that karma on our consciousness, but it actually helps to purify and to move us forward in our understanding.
Purify?
Yeah, when we get to the four opponent powers, when we get to the actual purification practice, that kind of very psychologically healthy practice of how to, you know, purifying action already completely done. The first of the and most important of those purifying factors is regret. So too, but even at the time of the action, like say for instance, it's a mental state. Remember, some of these are mental states. We don't have a whole lot of control of some of our most habitual mental states, of some of our akusala mental states, right? We don't have a whole lot of control over them. Yeah. The mind is stuck on something, is obsessed by something. Just to know, I know this is an akusala mental state. I know this is regrettable. Means not a complete action. Just knowing that. So you see how important it is how important these teachings are. If you don't know, you can't regret. Which means you can't. You're not going to get any of the learning benefit that you do when you create a negative action, and you have insight into the regrettable nature of it. In the same way, you know, if you've got a hot stove and you put your finger on the burner, you regret it. Damn! Wish I hadn't done that. Yeah. And then you think, now my finger is going to be blistered and I'm not going to be able to type on my emails for a week. I regret it. Yeah. And note also with that regret is not guilt. You know, you never, when you put your finger on that hot burner, you never say, I'm such a bad person for putting my finger on that hot burner.
I might say, I'm such a dumb person.
Well, that would be correct. And in a way, that's true. We would never put our finger on the hot burner if we really understood that we were about to be burned. In the same way, we wouldn't create a negative action if we really, really understood the consequential result. Yeah? We've got the reason we create negative action is because we've got a little feeling, oh, this is going to actually make me happy. And that we trust that more than this, that the delayed gratification route will make us happier. Yeah?
Could it also simply be that we're just deluded?
Well, that's, it is, yes, deluded. That's, yeah.
See how that could be.
Yeah, well, that's right. Negative. Maybe we don't even, we don't see at all that it's, we're sure that, we're sure that drinking that whiskey is going to just make us feel better and happier. No question.
That's delusion.
Yeah, it's delusion. But we could also say it's a mistake about the causes of happiness and the nature of happiness. It's a mistake. If we understood the nature of happiness and the causes of happiness, then we would create them, wouldn't we? But we're still not really completely sure. Or some, it's not, that's not the only reason. Actually, sometimes it's a mindfulness problem. Because even knowing the causes, what is akusala, what is kusala, still we forget, frankly. We just forget. We're not on top of it. We do a thing and then we don't realize till long after, oh, this is just exactly what I didn't want to do or what I don't want to do. Yeah, along with the understanding of what is the cause of happiness, what is the cause of suffering, is also the mindfulness to be able to put that into action in our daily life. So this regret and rejoicing. So when we do a positive action, we want to, you know, make that a complete action. So that's what I was saying before, it's so important in our practice to pay attention to our positive actions, to rejoice in them. You know, note when some habitual emotional pattern arises in the mind, some akusala mental pattern that you meet frequently. It arises in the mind, and then through your mindfulness, you're able to see its arising and its passing away. And you have a sense, oh, I see the impermanence of even that thing that seems so solid and heavy. I see its impermanence. Note, that's a virtuous action. That's a positive action to note. Just that small thing is beautiful and positive to see the impermanence. This is a wisdom moment. Yeah? So, rejoice in that. Cool. I just noted the impermanence of that irritation. That anxiety, that depressive thought. Yeah? Okay, so another really important, another very important factor in the weight of actions, yeah, are what we call the six, what are they, the six factors of weight, is that what we're calling, the six factors of weightiness? Okay, the six factors of weightiness, and my list reads a little bit different, and I like to do them slightly in different order, so don't mind if mine's a little bit different, but it's basically the same. So, the first factor that adds weightiness or reduces weightiness in an action is frequency. So, the frequency of either a negative or a positive action affects its weight. So, things that we engage in frequently have greater weight. They have greater impact on us. They make a heavier dent in the consciousness. They leave a heavier mark, a heavier trail. All of these are a little bit incorrect, but you know what I'm saying. They impact us less. They impact us more. Things that, and you could see why. I mean, this is just basically, this is common sense. Something that is repeatedly done creates a habit, and it's going to be stronger and stronger and less and more difficult to, you know, get your foot in that door just by sheer repetition. So they like to say that, well, idle speech, for instance, that's got a lot of weight because we engage in it frequently. We'll talk about speech again, but this idle speech, basically, if I might say, it's not just chatting and talking, because a lot of speech has much social benefit. They build our relationships. They build our friendships. Even, you know, just shooting the breeze and talking about the game on Sunday, which I would never do since I don't even know what the game is. But for those of you who go to work and do have to talk about the game on Sunday, or, you know, what you planted in the garden over the weekend, you know, with your coworker on Monday. These are relationship-building discussions. They build connections. And they're important with our Sangha members, that we build relationships, friendships, and connections with our Sangha members, of course, with our coworkers, and our neighbors, others, everyone. What distinguishes idle speech is speech that is accompanied by particularly craving and anger. So, like, speech that rails about something or someone, you know, the water cooler speech about so and so in such a department, going on and on about, you know, some nice thing that you purchased on a special deal at such and such a place, and you know, maybe even you're a little happy that the person is kind of envious that you got such a great thing, and it's a great deal, and or maybe they think you're special because you got this great nice thing now. I'm just pointing out here about idle speech that it's not just, sometimes Buddhists think that we should, you know, just walk around silently, and except on retreat now. On retreat we should walk around silently. But in our daily life, friendliness is an important kusala quality. Other beings need us to be friendly. But this other kind of speech happens a lot. This kind of idle speech, or gossip might characterize it well. We do it a lot, so it has a lot of impact. We don't often kill another human being, actually. So in some ways, you could almost say that the weightier thing is the thing, the weightier in terms of impact on us, is this frequently engaged in harmful talk. Yeah? So frequency. And you all are thinking of all the other, your other little bad habits, whatever they are, that you do frequently. Your favorite little bad habit that you engage in frequently. Yeah, so frequency. So to cut down the frequency, and also to understand that something that is very unusually done is going to have less impact on us than something that we do frequently. So the slippery slope of, oh, well, I've done it once, so, you know, it's too late now, the hopeless kind of, okay, I might as well do it again because I've already cooked my goose. It makes a difference that we not do it again. Yeah. Okay, so frequency. The second is the presence of an opponent mental state. So, for instance, we were talking about regret. So the presence of an opponent mental state, for instance, so we swat the fly, but there is the healthy and virtuous mental state of regret. This is a wisdom, understanding this is not a good thing to do. Or the example that Venerable was giving, where we were talking about, a scientist that's trying to develop, a cure for malaria that kills, millions of people worldwide, and engages in testing. Well, his illness is doing is employing these factors to help mitigate that action. So he's saying, have compassion for those creatures. So he's saying, have compassion. So he's suggesting, have compassion, do as little harm as possible, have regret. Which isn't to say that the scientist is not creating karma. He is. So His Holiness is not saying there's no karma there. It's just that if we understand the factors that can reduce the impact of the negativity, then we can lessen the impact of the karma. Even, that Mahayana story about the one of the Buddha's past lives. I don't think they tell this so much in the Theravada tradition. And even in the Mahayana tradition, they're really careful about it because it's often taken as as kind of an excuse to, higher realized beings to do actions that appear to be negative. That's in the Mahayana as well as the Theravada. Personal integrity is the basis of concentration and wisdom. It is the foundational practice. So a Mahayana practitioner that is not practicing ethics and personal integrity as rigorously as anyone else is not practicing the Mahayana teachings, just to say. So there's this story of when the Bodhisattva in a past life was he was a captain on a ship. He was a captain on a boat. And he had a vision that one of the passengers on the boat was going to kill the other people on the boat and rob them. And so the Bodhisattva decided that he would, out of compassion for the person who is going to create that negative karma, he killed that passenger before he could do it. And now people say, he had that great compassion and he engaged in that action out of pure selfless compassion. Well, when His Holiness, I believe it was in the Gelug Kagyu practice of Mahamudra, he talks about this story and he says, even with that great compassion that the Bodhisattva had, there was karma. There was akusala karma. So karma does not make exceptions. As I said the other night, karma is a machine. It is not a justice principle where nice people with, who are nice get away with things and the other ones don't get away with it. karma is a machine, and akusala actions affect us. They're mitigated by all of these other factors, but karma will always operate if there's some negativity. Okay, so as soon as I get through these six, I'll take some questions. So then the presence of an opponent. So as I said, the presence of compassion, the presence of regret. And any other opposing mental state. And likewise, a positive action can also be weakened by the presence of, an act of generosity that is accompanied by kind of the wish to that the other person will praise us, for instance. Still, you've got the good karma. You also have good. There is karma there, positive karma for involved in that generosity. You haven't gotten rid of that karma, but you've weakened it. You've weakened the energy of that positive action because there's some kind of self-directed benefit there, for instance. Or maybe you give, but you're irritated. Or maybe you even have a two-pointed mind and you kind of regret giving. I'm going to give this $100 to this hospital, but you're like, oh, I can't stand it, I hate it, I wish I weren't doing this. So you can undermine your, weaken your positive actions as well as your negative actions. Then the third is the intensity of the accompanying disturbing attitude. So, for instance, our example of swatting the fly, so perhaps you have a lot of anger, and it's quite, or let's go back to the policeman example, that's a good one. So His Holiness is talking about the police officer, and His Holiness says, sometimes there are situations in which, you as a police officer have to use force to protect people and to subdue someone who's violent. And then His Holiness says, use as little force as possible. And that's going to be cause the least, we haven't gotten to that one yet, but it's about causing the least suffering. And then he says, and have compassion, which is to generate an opposing mental state. And then, of course, to regret the necessity for doing that. But also, if there's anger, if there's a lot of anger and a lot of hatred, that's going to be a much heavier action than if the guy is just doing his duty and kind of dispassionately without an arising hatred, committing a violent act against that person. So you see there's a big difference between those two actions, and there's a big difference in how those actions would affect the doer. Because an action that's done with a lot of hatred, for instance, that's a much, deeper cut in the consciousness. And then also, there's just if there's a lot of... and likewise then with our positive actions, to get the most energy in our positive actions, it's to really enjoy, let your emotion rise, be happy to be generous, feel thrilled to be patient, So, and then the fourth is the intensity of the deed itself, or to take the joy in the suffering of the other. And clearly, that would clearly increase the weight of the action, and clearly that, you know, contradicts the possibility, makes impossible regret, for instance, to actually take joy in the suffering of the other. And then the fifth is the weight of the object, meaning that, for instance, and you feel this yourself, there's a difference between swatting the fly and killing a human being, for instance. Clearly. They say that the parents, to harm the parents, the ones to whom you're indebted, that that's a very weighty object to harm, to do harm to the ones that have benefited you. Even sometimes they like to say the smaller animals less weighty than the bigger animals. I don't know, as a smaller person, I'm not so wild about that one.
It's weird that there's a hierarchy in value of life.
Yeah. But there is a there is a difference between an animal and a human being, not in terms of potential, because an animal has exactly the same potential for Buddhahood from the Buddhist perspective as a human being, but a human being with a precious human life with the resources and freedoms to practice the Dharma, to develop wisdom and compassion, to develop equanimity regarding difficult ones and dear ones, the ability to develop compassion even for those who harm us. I mean, this is something that an animal can never do. My cat, great and wonderful as she is, extraordinary being who just barely missed Harvard.
She can't do it in her present state.
That's right. That's right. Okay. She can't do it in her present state. She can't generate compassion and love for the one who is not nice to her. Yeah. That would be a lack of wisdom, I'm afraid.
But she has
the potential but basically the idea is, and we've all had cat lives, you know. We've all had it from the Buddhist point of view. We've all had all different kinds of lives. So we've got this life, and now, you know, all these other beings in the world are counting on their ability to practice Dharma in the future depends on, you know, us making some progress. And frankly, even at this point, even the survival of animals on this planet depends on us making some progress. Trading, you know, we're going to have to learn to be renounced about our... We're going to have to find value and meaning in life other than in consumption and the consumption of natural resources. Because if we don't, we're going to suck up every ounce of everything this planet has to offer until it is denuded, and there is nothing left for any creature, human or animal. So, so anyway, we have, there's a responsibility that goes along with this privilege of, there's a responsibility that goes along with having the human rebirth that we can say it is a more weighty act to kill a human being than it is to kill a mosquito, for instance. And the responsibility is that we should develop wisdom and compassion because we have a karmic connection with all of these animals. And from lifetime to lifetime, their practice depends on our practice. It's a very big view. It's a very big view, and the Tibetans excel in this very big view. It's a very cosmic view that extends back in time and forward into the future. It extends into multiple world systems. It's a very, like, I don't know, quantum physics kind of view that is really amazing. And, I mean, it's, in some ways you could say, you know, our Dharma practice, it's a process of creating a bigger and bigger view that's more and more inclusive. You know, you start out, you have a very narrow me view in which everything you see is colored by your very narrow view of me and mine and what I want and what I don't want. And everything else that falls outside of that scope, we don't even see. Friends and enemies, the reified perception of friends and enemies, you know, we have a very narrow slip, and only right now, only our present wants and needs right now. Immediate gratification. So in time and among beings and in space, it's very limited in the beginning. Gradually our Dharma practice is we're increasing our breath. We're increasing our sense of connection to other beings, including animals. We're increasing our sense of our extension in time into the future and actually into the past. So anyway, we don't necessarily have to get on board with that really huge view, but it's interesting and compelling to think about, and probably quite correct and much closer to correct than anything our narrow, limited view can cook up. That's definite. So, where was I here? Animal. We were talking about animals, yeah. And so while we're on animals, then let's do this vegetarian thing again. So let me say about the 10 negative actions, these 10 akusalakshas, these are not the only negative actions. These are just like 10 big representative categories in which most negative actions tend to be able to fit them into one or the other. But it's not an inclusive list. And it's only a conceptual list. It's conceptual. Basically, actions that harm, actions motivated by craving, anger, and ignorance are akusala, whether they're on this list or not. So the Buddha didn't have motor oil. It's not negative action in the 10 list, the 10 negative actions list, to dump your motor oil down a sewer drain. But that's a negative action. Yeah, just because it's not on the list doesn't mean it's not a negative action. If it harms another, or harms ourselves, because of course if we harm ourselves, we're going to harm others. Yeah, and we're dangerous if we're harming ourselves. If the action harms another, it is going to carry karma. So it is true that, you know, the technical description of killing does not include eating meat. Yeah? So the fullest weight of killing is to actually actively kill an animal. The fullest weight is to kill a human being, yeah? Less to kill an animal. But you all feel uncomfortable, and rightly so, with the idea that somebody else can kill the animal for you, and it's okay. It's not the same as killing the animal, or it's not the same as asking somebody to kill the animal for you. Just because, you know, you go to the grocery and you buy your hamburger, the weight isn't the same. Because now you're going to know, you're going to understand this, the complexity, the nuance of the karma, which is going to allow you to be able to face the smaller negativities now. Yeah? Because you're going to understand it's not all the same. It's not the same to kill an animal as it is to go to the grocery and buy the hamburger. It's different. It has a different effect on your mind. But
to me, that's worse.
Because you've got somebody else doing it.
You're not only having someone kill the animal for you,
mm-hmm.
but you're creating pain in that person
who
has to do the killing for you.
Yeah.
It would be better to do it yourself, to my way of thinking.
That's very possible.
The people that work in those places that kill the animals have horrible, horrible jobs.
Yes.
And
even dangerous jobs.
They're often people who really live on the margins of society
because
they're paid poorly and
right. They
maybe can't find any other work.
Right.
So to me, it's worse.
Yeah.
To cause someone to kill for you so that you
right.
can buy it in the supermarket in a plastic pink wrapper.
That's right. In plastic, too.
Yeah. So that's...
Yeah. I agree with that, actually, although it kind of depends a little bit from culture to culture, because remember, I'm thinking the Tibetans, so, you know, there they are at, you know, 15,000 feet where nothing grows, and if they don't eat meat, they die. So they have this particular precept is, it gets pushed to the limit, to the edge of, you know, the difficulty to think about, because... It's either they have to eat meat or they will die. And even His Holiness, who espouses vegetarianism, and when he goes to visit one of the monasteries, the whole monastery becomes vegetarian while he's there in his honor. But nevertheless, his doctor says you have to eat meat. So now he eats some meat. But he regrets it. He remembers those beings in his practice. He feels like he's made a karmic connection with them. He speaks out against cruelty to animals. He asks his students to reduce their meat as much as they can. And I'm sure he accepts also that there is nevertheless some karma, because it is a machine and it affects you. Just because no being wants to lose its life, and that's a heavy thing. So, yeah, I agree with you that I'll accept that entirely, that it's in... And we all know that, too. So, you know, because... You know, the Buddhist ethics has the ability to grow with the sensitivity of the culture. So the idea that, you know, the workers who are working in those factories, that's a terrible job, it's dangerous, they get injured, they lose limbs, fingers, they get sick, terrible working conditions, parasites, all kinds of things like that. Like, this is a little advance in society, in our cultural awareness, that we can understand and we can afford actually to care about those values. If we go back, you know, 200 years, well, then the butcher, this is a way of making a livelihood, and that's way better than being dead, for instance. And, you know, he's feeding his family. So it, you know, it these things change. And Buddhist ethics allows us to use our highest sense of where harm and benefit is accruing. So it's not like a simplistic ethics. If you want simplistic ethics, go with the Ten Commandments. You know, it's just, it does, it makes you responsible. It allows you to increase your sense of personal integrity as your own understanding about harm, the actions, your actions in the world and their impact. Like, for instance, dumping the motor oil in the sewer drain. Well, my parents would have, my dad would have never known, that would never have thought this is a problem. Yeah? Now we know. We all know that. So, yes. Yes, we want to hold ourselves to the highest standard that we possibly can conceive of and enact. Have compassion for ourselves where we cannot. Do better. And regret for those actions that create harm, despite our best intentions. And weaken the effect, the harm of those actions as much as possible. It's a very compassionate view, and it's growth-oriented. It allows us to not live in denial, to accept our negative actions, and to deepen our practice of personal integrity. Practice of personal integrity is an incredible lifelong practice. It's just as rich and beautiful a practice as any in the Buddha Dharma. And never in our lives do we get to the point where we think we know everything that's good and bad, and that we are completely capable of doing it. The world is too complicated. Even to do good in the world. What's his name that wrote Mountains Beyond Mountains?
Tracy Kidder.
You know, he writes about going to Honduras to work with MDA. Paul Farmer, to work with multi-drug-resistant MDR tuberculosis. And he says in his book, he says, well, I wanted to go there because it's one of the few places where I could go and work and be sure that I wasn't creating unintended harms. So, of course, we're not responsible for our unintended harms. And, you know, if I think of the previous generation dumping motor oil in the drain, I have a lot of compassion for that, and I feel they really didn't have a clue. And there's many things that we're doing right now that are similar. Now we know about motor oil in the sewer drain. But there's lots of other things that in about three more generations they're going to look back and they're going to say, those people, look what they did. And we are not even aware right now of what that is. But I got some ideas of what it might be. So we have to... What was that?
There's a parking lot out there.
Yes, that's right. There's a parking lot out there, exactly. Yeah, that's right.
Our computers and our cell phones. And
full of rare substances that are... We're trading...
Talk about a terrible industry.
Mm-hmm, that's right. Yeah, it's a complex, difficult world. And so this practice, as I said, it's a beautiful and incredible practice. It requires paying attention, doing our best, having a lot of compassion for ourselves, which makes us compassionate for others. Because we can't be compassionate for others if we're not compassionate for ourselves. And it gives us a lot of humility as we see how difficult it is to do good. When we see how difficult it is to do good. And one of the great benefits of becoming very intimate with your own mind and motivation is to also realize how difficult it is to stop negative habits, negative actions. And then that gives us a lot of compassion for everybody else out there with their negative actions and negative habits. And that compassion is very potent and powerful in the world. Okay, so the weight of the object. And then finally, the nature of the act, the very nature of the act in causing greater suffering to the other. So an action that causes greater suffering to the other is weightier in terms of its karmic impact. And so then just let me say about these six that these are really important to understand. And without them and without the four factors in a complete action, without understanding them, our understanding of karma and positive and negative actions is very simplistic. You see, it's very, very complex. And with all of the four factors and the six factors, different weights of the causes, that any particular action is going to be, surprise, surprise, completely unique. A completely unique and different action, which is composed of the doer's defilements, the doer's contradictory mental states, the nature of the action itself, how much suffering it's causing, all of these things interacting to make each and every action quite unique. But you see, there's a lot of places here where you can work with lessening the impact of these actions on the mind. And remember, this is so much the guts of our practice, because we're creating our future consciousness. We're creating ourselves, and this is how we're doing it with our positive and negative actions, which includes all of our states of mindfulness, of our states of insight, states of effort, our states of patience, all of these kusala actions. We're creating ourselves with those actions, and we're, I said I was going to take questions. I'll take one or two questions. One question, maybe. Maybe that's enough. That's enough, isn't it? Okay, that's enough. Good enough. Important, the four and the six. Okay, I'll remind us of these again, maybe most other evenings, just so that we can get really ingrain them in our memories.
Could you just get the headlines of the six again? Because I got lost.
The headlines are frequency. Yeah, yeah, they are. And the outline, they just might have a different name. They're in different order. The nature, okay, so the nature causing greater suffering. So put a dash at the end and say causing greater suffering, greater or lesser suffering. And then the weight of the object, you know that one, right? And then according to the intention, and that is the intensity of either the akusala or kusala mental state. So the intention is the intensity of the accompanying akusala or kusala mental state. And then the means is causing greater or lesser suffering. So how it's done, greater or lesser suffering to the other. Frequency, that one's an easy one. And heaviness according to the lack of opposing factor. And opposing factors can be, for instance, regret or compassion. Or they could be anger, self-centeredness, craving, the whole range of all the negatives and positives. Jealousy, you know, you do a negative thing and it's accompanied with a whole lot of jealousy. Like some little speech thing, you know, like this, we could talk about these factors with speech. Oh, the speech things, the things that we... the acts of speech, you know, they get involved with these varying factors and get very nuanced. You know, you can say just a little thing with a whole lot of jealousy behind it, and it becomes a very heavy action. Okay. So let's just take a minute to dedicate, to rejoice, to seal our positive action today. Let's think, may all of this beautiful mindfulness, contemplation, presence, kindness, generosity, wisdom that we are cultivating, that we cultivated today, may that all ripen in our own development, and may our qualities then radiate out and benefit every person that we come, every being that we come in contact with, human and animal. Benefiting beings and radiating circles of karmic connection throughout the universe.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.